My name's Dr. Thomas Round, and I'm a GP and academic researcher. I'm also the RCGP Essential Knowledge Updates clinical lead. And today in this podcast, I'm talking to Dr. Nick Jones, who's one of our EKU authors. He's also a GP in Oxford and an academic researcher into cardiovascular disease. And on today's discussion, we're talking about the recent NICE venous thromboembolism guidelines, or VTE, which you covered in a recent EKU, Nick.
Yeah, that's right. So we covered this recently, and we've produced a summary article, which we are hoping to submit to the BJGP as well. I think this is a really interesting guideline because there has been quite a few changes from previous recommendations. And obviously, there's some crossover with the work I do around stroke prevention, anticoagulation, and the sort of increasing prominence of DOACs in that field. And I think that's really carried forward into the new VTE guidelines. And I think as a primary care clinician, you know, this is a type of diagnosis that we don't see that often, but it's obviously something that's important to be aware of and to get right when it does come up. And I think actually the guidelines are really helpful in perhaps simplifying some of those tricky decisions that we used to have around sort of initiating warfarin and when that might happen, and also clarifying some of the symptoms and times when we want to make sure that we refer patients for assessment in a timely fashion.
And I guess we should say VTE, we talk about venous thromboembolism, which is DVT and pulmonary embolisms. And I guess, as you said, I haven't had a patient for a while, but I guess low prevalence in primary care, but it's one of those diagnoses not to miss.
Yeah, absolutely. Something we all know going back to med school, the associated mortality, particularly with PEs. And I think it's probably important to say that the focus of the NICE guideline is on proximal DVTs in the lower limb. So there's some sort of debate about the importance of distal DVTs. Although in practice, if you're kind of concerned about a lower limb DVT, then you probably want to assess it in the same way at the outset until you've got an ultrasound determining where it is. But yeah, I think they are rare diagnoses, but ones that are important to treat and also important to sort of recognize and treat in a timely fashion, because obviously untreated, then there can be further consequences and a high rate of mortality, particularly for people with PE. So I think the important thing, considering them and having them on your radar and then knowing what can sort of help to make the diagnosis more or less likely, and thinking about the referral pathways once you've got that thought in your head.
Maybe we should have a little think consider the last patient we've seen or considered VTE when it come in. So I haven't had one for a while, but the last one was acutely swollen lower leg, which I referred, and that wasn't actually a DVT. I mean, have you had any recent cases, and how would you risk assess?
Yeah, so I had one in primary care not long ago. It was probably about 6 months ago. A young lady, I think in her early 30s, she was on the combined contraceptive pill, and she'd had some relatively mild but pleuritic muscle aches in her chest, and she had a mild sinus tachycardia. I think her heart rate was low 100s. It was difficult because she wasn't low in terms of oxygen saturations, and pain was relatively mild, but on the other hand, she was tachycardic. And I think it was one of those situations where you're sort of looking at a patient who looks relatively well in front of you, but on the other hand, you've got some objective measures there that something could be going on. And I think the NICE guidelines will very strongly encourage us in that situation to say that it's difficult for us to exclude a PE in primary care, and therefore we should think about referring them to secondary care for further investigation, because a treatment decision should be taken within 4 hours if possible. And the treatment decision there could be in terms of starting an anticoagulant, or in terms of getting the next test back and deciding on the basis of a normal D-timer or other tests that a PE or DVT is unlikely. So I think it's quite typical to have vague symptoms with either a PE or DVT. You know, say for a PE, typical symptoms might be some pleuritic chest pain, might be breathlessness, but it can also present in people with a sinus tachycardia that is otherwise unexplained. And then DVT, typical symptoms are obviously a sort of swollen leg, unilateral pain in the calf, and with redness or heat. But I think what's also really important to comment is that individual symptoms have a low positive predictive value. So when you look at the positive predictive value of individual symptoms for a DVT, none of them has a value over about 30%, so even sort of unilateral calf pain. The negative predictive value, so of all symptoms combined, is pretty high. So if you don't have any swollen leg or calf pain or redness there, then the negative predictive value of that is in the high 90s. So you can be quite confident about trying to rule out DVTs in people without symptoms, for example. But actually diagnosing it is more difficult, particularly if someone has one of those objective symptoms.
And obviously, people may have heard of the Wells score, which we can potentially use in primary care. Is there any other scoring tools that you might use to help risk assess?
Yeah, so the new one, which is now recommended in the latest NICE guidelines, is for PEs, and it's called the PERC score, which is the pulmonary embolism rule out criteria. This is a score which you can use to help exclude a PE without further investigation. They're quite relatively stringent criteria. So for example, anybody who's age 50 or older automatically scores 1 point on the PERC score, and therefore you can't use it to exclude a PE. They have to score zero. Similarly, anyone who's on a combined contraceptive pill will score a point and you can't use it. So it's really useful in sort of selective younger patients where it can be helpful in ruling it out with further testing. I think the other thing that's important to say about it is that it was developed in the emergency department setting. Prevalence of pulmonary embolism might be higher, and it hasn't yet been validated in primary care studies. So, you know, a little bit of caution, I suppose, has to be used around that. I think the other thing about the PERC score is my own experience of it is it's often helpful in providing you a little bit of reassurance in someone who you thought probably actually didn't have a PE anyway. You know, if it's a young person and they're not tachycardic and their oxygen levels are fine and there's no reason why they would have a PE and all these sort of things, then, you know, your pretest probability, if you like, of them having a PE pretty low anyway before you even run the PERC score, but it can provide that sort of extra backup in that context. I think the really important thing to say about the WELL score is that the WELL score is not designed as a PE or DVT rule-out score. So if you do a WELL score, even if you get minus one or zero, you shouldn't be documenting that WELL score is zero, therefore I don't think this is a PE or a DVT. The WELL score is designed and suggested by NICE to come in once you think someone might have a DVT to help risk stratify them and then decide about what type of investigation they need.
So I think the key thing there is to be on your radar and to think about potential diagnoses as a GP. And even if the predictive value is low, if that's on your radar, probably you need to start thinking about risk managing for that.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, the bottom line is because we need to get a quick turnaround in terms of test results so that we can try and meet that 4-hour target of having a treatment decision made. That really means that it's going to be quite difficult to do that in primary care. And usually that might mean, depending on local pathways, discussion with the medical team or the emergency department. We've had some discussion around this already, Tom, I know, and pathways do differ in different parts of the UK. So people will need to be familiar with how that works. And it probably will vary depending on whether you're concerned about a PE, where there's more likely to be the need for an acute referral to the medical team or to accident emergency. Some local pathways for DVT will allow you to think about initiating sort of bridging anticoagulant treatment with the plan for a DVT clinic appointment within the next 24 hours, say. But I think to go back to that point, I absolutely agree. I think if it's on your radar, it's difficult to exclude it in primary care based on symptoms or signs alone. And therefore, it's likely to need further testing in a very sort of timely manner.
I'm just thinking about sort of COVID in the COVID situation we're in. And obviously, that there's a higher risk of VTE with COVID, if I understand correctly. So we might potentially see more of clotting going forward.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think also we're going to see more patients who are breathless, you know, long COVID, perhaps have had prolonged hospital admissions and might have other risk factors for a PE. I think it's a really sort of murky area at the moment. And I suppose that comes back to that thing of having a low threshold for making sure that we're considering PE and investigating it, because the last thing you want to do is, you know, miss it in someone who's breathless after a recent hospital admission with COVID and put it down to an alternative diagnosis like long COVID without adequately excluding it. So I think the risk is higher, but also the likelihood of seeing patients with alternative diagnoses is higher. And that's going to be a challenge for clinicians going forward.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. On the last case I had, which was, as I say, the swollen leg. So in our local area, the pathway is we refer to A&E, and they have a rapid response team which we can contact directly, and they would assess the patient, do the WELL score, do the D-dimers, and then make a decision on the treatment. So that kind of bit is taken out of my hands. But as we reflected on, if we think about PE, we would probably prefer into medics for assessment. But I guess in some other areas you might be doing more of the management in a primary care situation.
Yeah, and I think that is the case in Oxford, that there is a DVT clinic here where it's usually possible to get people seen the following day, even on the weekend. It's a nurse-led service and they have same-day access there to Doppler ultrasound. So the pathway here might be that if you saw someone with a suspected DVT, that you would speak to those nurses on the phone, arrange a next-day appointment, but in the meantime, take the baseline blood test for things like the D-dimer and the renal function, but also give them a bridging anticoagulant for the 24-hour period to last them through till the following day where they were seen and had that next sort of assessment made.
So I guess that brings neatly on to anticoagulation and the sort of changes within that. So if you were in that situation where you were giving a bridging and prescription, it would be for a DOAC.
Yeah, and I think this is another change here where NICE now very clearly recommend DOACs in this situation. And particularly that is using either apixaban or rivaroxaban. The benefit of that is obviously that you will achieve a target treatment dose much more quickly than either trying to get someone on warfarin, which is going to be difficult to do, or thinking about how you might use dalteparin or a low molecular weight heparin in that type of situation. So they're a very, very helpful tool in this scenario. I think a few things about that bridging treatment. One is that NICE suggests that even if people don't have a recent renal function, as long as they're not known to have significant kidney impairment, the risk probably of not treating them outweighs the benefits of using a DOAC, i.e. do use a DOAC in that scenario without waiting to get their kidney function back, but do send off an up-to-date use knees so that you can know that, you know, their sort of kidney function is going to be okay to continue the DOAC going forward. I think the other sort of interesting thing around the DOACs is traditionally there has been an emphasis on using warfarin in people, or low molecular weight heparin in people with active cancer. And yet recent studies such as the Amplify study and Recover studies had some subgroup analyses of people with cancer where they were seemed to be safe actually to use the DOACs. And although there is yet to be marketing authorization for the DOACs in these groups, NICE are already suggesting that they may well be suitable. Now, this again might not be a primary care decision, but I think it's something to be aware of, and I think there's likely to be an increasing move towards DOACs being the first line anticoagulant in most situations, with warfarin and heparin being the backup in sort of the few circumstances where they're not suitable.
I mean, that's a really interesting change, and I think with DOACs now becoming more widely used, I have during the pandemic switched a few patients over from warfarin to a DOAC for stable AF treatment. So I think probably we're getting more confident in utilising these drugs in primary care and potentially even initiating them sometimes.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think, you know, the real world data is supporting those use and the safety of drugs, particularly sort of apixaban in terms of the safety profile in comparison to warfarin. And I think that their benefits are numerous. The reduction in monitoring is a big thing. So I had a pretty difficult case where someone who'd come out of hospital just a couple of weeks ago and was in a nursing home and had had an INR sent off that was underfilled. And I had to sort of cycle up there on a Friday evening to get one sent, and it was a nightmare. And I was sort of thinking, you know, if only they're on a DOAC. So I think that side of things is obviously very helpful. And with that comes a sort of safety issue. You know, if people have poorly controlled INRs, if it's a low INR, obviously there's a risk of a stroke or whatever you're sort of trying to prevent with the anticoagulant happening. And similarly, if they've got over-warfarinized a high INR, then the bleeding risk that comes with that. So they're much more stable, aren't they, the DOACs, which I think is a point in their favor. We do still need to be aware of the contraindications, the need to get the dosing right, depending on things like body weight and renal function and age and these types of factors. But I think they do add a very, very useful tool in our armory in terms of primary care, rapid onset of anticoagulation in these semi-acute presentations like sort of ETE and DVT.
And then I guess with a scenario of a patient, it has then started on a bridging prescription, then they have their diagnostic tests. So that would be, as you said, Doppler ultrasound if it were you suspecting DVT, or that would be a CT PA, right, if we're thinking about PE.
So that'd be based on a well score, wouldn't it? So if they had a low well score, either DVT or PE, then usually D-dimer is the next test. So if it's sort of a low risk well score, but you think that they may have either, then it's a D-dimer.
Yep.
If they're considered high risk, then they're suggested just to go straight to having the ultrasound scan or the CTPA. I think it is important to know for pathways where the GP is involved in bridging anticoagulation, it is still recommended that you take a D-dimer even if you're referring someone for a Doppler ultrasound. And the reason for that is that if the person is considered high risk but has a negative Doppler ultrasound scan, the D-dimer will decide about whether they need to have a repeat scan or not. So if they have had a negative D-dimer scan, but they were considered high risk and they had an ultrasound scan that was negative, you could say they don't have DVT. If they had a high D-dimer result, even if they have a negative Doppler ultrasound scan, they should then have a repeat Doppler ultrasound scan to make sure that's correct.
And that's if they're so, high risk, high baseline
yeah,
risk.
Yeah, so if they're at high risk, exactly. So for most people, if you're going to assess them for a DVT or a PE, they need to have a D-dimer taken before anticoagulation started. Now, you know, in some pathways, GPs won't get involved in that. You'll have thought about it and you're refer them on to secondary care for assessment. But if you're thinking about it and you're thinking about bridging anticoagulation, then it's good practice to try and get the D-dimer taken first.
I guess then once we've had the diagnostic test, as you say, either yes or no, or they might need a follow-up scan, what's the sensitivity and sort of pickup from these tests? They're pretty reliable, the CT and the Doppler.
Yeah, they're pretty reliable. I mean, it depends. So for a Doppler ultrasound, they're more reliable for proximal DVTs, which is good, though, because that's, you know, the one you want to pick up, and probably a sensitivity of around 90 to 95% in that scenario. I think CTPA, it probably depends slightly on things like the clot size, but, you know, similar accuracy for CTPA for people with a pulmonary embolism.
And then I think the more common scenario then might be we might get a discharge summary or discharge information. Then that patient has been picked up that they've got a venous thromboembolism, either the PE or the DVT, and then we'd be potentially then taking over that prescription. I think that might be a not uncommon encounter.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what probably should happen in most scenarios in the UK is that there should be some haematology follow-up to give some advice about the duration of anticoagulation. For many people, it depends a little bit on whether it's considered a provoked or unprovoked VTE. So a unprovoked VTE would be one where there's, you know, no obvious sort of trigger for it. And in that scenario, often 3 months of anticoagulation is considered sufficient. A provoked VTE is one where it's related to something like active cancer or recent surgery, being on the combined pill, one of these sort of factors. And in that scenario, it's usually considered for 6 months of anticoagulation, but possibly longer, depending on whether the trigger for the VTE is modifiable or not. So if you've had a PE because you have a ongoing cancer and that cancer is, you know, not something that's going to be curative, you're going to be on continued treatment, there may be a consideration of continuing the anticoagulation beyond 6 months and sometimes longer term. So I would say in the UK, usually hematology advice is helpful for that, and I would say in most scenarios that happens, but certainly in my practice I've had a couple of people where they've been diagnosed through the medical tape, started on an anticoagulant and then not had hematology follow-up. And in that scenario, I suppose, you know, it depends a little bit in terms of how confident you are, but you may well want to liaise with a hematologist or refer to the NICE guidelines around what their advice is on duration.
But ideally they should have that follow-up from clinical encounter from secondary care.
That's certainly the usual path. You don't want people taking anticoagulation long term if they don't need to because of the bleeding risk. So I think if you could stop it after 3 months, it wouldn't be great if they were still on it in a year just because they hadn't seen the hematology follow-up and no one had considered the need to stop it. It would be a really bad practice.
Also, we factored a little bit on DOAC prescribing, but some areas may have a shared care agreement where prescriptions, patients maybe get an initial prescription from secondary care, stabilisation, and then we take over in primary care. Or potentially, I think some areas may have training for GPs, or they might have for initiation in primary care.
Yeah, I think there is still quite a bit of variety around this, isn't it? And I think when you look at the variation in anticoagulation prescribing across the UK, it's quite interesting that the proportion of anticoagulants, which are DOACs, varies hugely between different parts of the country, and that will reflect local pathways and practice. I suspect that things probably will change with the move towards increasing DOAC prescriptions, that it will probably become simpler for GPs to initiate or continue DOACs without so much secondary care input. But obviously, you know, it does depend on local practice for people about how they're doing that. I think another scenario that can sometimes happen is people moving to the UK on an anticoagulant from abroad. And again, that's something just to be aware of and making sure that they have had the right checks. One thing which you haven't sort of yet mentioned, which is a contraindication to being on a DOAC, is people who have certain types of antiphospholipid syndrome. And so usually that is something which the hematology team may be involved in testing for if people are going to be on anticoagulation with a DOAC long term. So, you know, again, it's just something that's worth being aware of if patients are moving to the UK on anticoagulants, making sure that they've had the right check and also that an active treatment decision has been made about how long they need to continue that for.
So going forward, we'll see less patients on warfarin, but I guess we might still see some patients on warfarin depending if the DOAC isn't licensed. As I understand, it's in certain weights. If people are underweight or overweight, they might benefit more from warfarin. Is that correct?
So generally under 50 kilos, over 120 kilograms are a contraindication to DOACs. You know, that's a relative contraindication, obviously, depending on how close they are to that cutoff. Others are severe renal impairments, so usually creatinine clearance of below 30 or below 20, depending. Sometimes people want to discuss it if it's below 30 or have an absolute cutoff if it's below 20. Pregnancy is considered a contraindication. Liver disease with coagulopathy or types of antiphospholipid syndrome. So those are the main contraindications when you're considering it in the VTE context. And obviously, there are some additional ones in stroke prevention around the types of, you know, whether there's any valve involvement and that type of thing.
And head-to-head warfarin versus DOAX, DOAX would be similar effectiveness or better?
In the VT context, pretty similar in terms of effectiveness and generally better safety profiles, so less bleeding with a similar effectiveness.
And then I guess if you think we're talking about patient-centered, if you're a patient and you have the option of either or, I think most people would probably go for the DOAX because you wouldn't need to have your regular INR testing.
Yeah, I think that's a huge benefit, isn't it? Particularly for people in the current time where they might feel reluctant to want to go into the GP service or where access to testing might be more limited for all sorts of reasons. I think it's a huge benefit. But even beyond that, getting INRs to a stable value varies from person to person, as everyone listening will know. And, you know, some people it's relatively quick and simple and other people it's almost impossible.
I think about having sleepless nights about INRs as a junior doctor.
Yeah.
And the nightmares of things going wrong and people having bleeds.
I'm sure everyone has had that experience, haven't they? And I think it is a real thing to be vigilant about. And, you know, I think there is lots of people who do very well on warfarin, and I think it will continue to have a role. But I think if I was a patient and you offered me the choice between a medicine where you likely to need a couple of blood tests annually, where the bleeding risk is lower and where there's less concerns about interactions with other medications and all dietary interactions that come with warfarin, I think I would pick a DOAC almost every time.
And any top tips from the guideline?
Small points, but one thing is that NICE now recommended age-adjusted D-dimer threshold, and that's based on the fact that D-dimers will gradually creep up with age anyway. So again, for many people, the D-dimer is going to be seen and interpreted in secondary care. But if you are in a situation where you're taking a D-dimer, that's something to be aware of, and you can find adjusted D-dimer calculations online to help with that. The other thing is some people may have access to point-of-care D-dimer testing, and when they've done diagnostic accuracy tests using lab D-dimer as the gold standard, these compare pretty well, but they are more expensive. And I think the problem with them is that most people won't be using them frequently enough either to be particularly familiar with them or to keep a stock in where they're going to be within sell-by date, because I gather they have a relatively short shelf life. So it may be that for most people working in primary care, that's not something that's particularly useful. But certainly if you did have access to point of care D-dimer testing, it's certainly something to consider. And in that scenario where you'd seen a patient and there was a suspicion of a DVT or PE, but you consider it to be a low index of suspicion based on a Wells score, then a point of care D-dimer testing might be helpful. But I think both those things are relatively small points. The summary, I think, in terms of sort of thinking about this for practice, number one, having PEs and DVTs on our radar, being aware that, you know, the sort of signs and symptoms are relatively non-specific. They have a low positive predictive value, and therefore actively diagnosing them is going to be difficult. But once we've had the thought about a DVT or a PE being a possibility, making a treatment choice to investigate that in a short time frame being the important thing. And for most people, that is likely to mean involvement in secondary care, usually on the same day. And some of the sort of next stages of treatment may then be taken over by the secondary care team, but it's likely to involve Wells testing to decide whether a D-dimer or a other investigation like a CTPA or ultrasound Doppler is needed. And then the big change there towards the DOACs for bridging and long-term anticoagulation, even in people who have active cancer, although, you know, that's an area of changing authorization. One other thing as well, actually, is previously NICE guidelines have talked about the need to look for undiagnosed cancers in people who have a new VTE that is otherwise unexplained. And there's been a change in recommendation here. So what they now suggest is that you should take a thorough clinical history and examination and consider cancer as one possible cause for a PE or DVT. But if the clinical assessment doesn't indicate any particular area of concern for cancer, you are not now recommended to go on and do things like chest x-rays or FIT tests or other investigations to look for cancer. And that recommendation was made on the fact that it seems like those tests were having a very low diagnostic yield, and also concerns about the anxiety that they might be promoting or provoking. Obviously, you're going to have a discussion with that patient that they may have an undiagnosed cancer. And then, you know, you do a chest x-ray, you do a FIT test, they come back negative, but you told the patient they might have cancer. How far are you going to go in trying to then provide the reassurance that it isn't a cancer that hasn't been picked up? So I think that's quite an important change, and, you know, one that GPs may find helpful in knowing about, because I think that sort of takes some of the emphasis away from those more sort of lab-based tests, if you like, and more of an emphasis on the clinical situation and the judgment that they make in the assessment with the patient.
Which is so important in primary care. It's our bread and butter of clinical assessments. Yeah, that's great. Well, thanks, Nate. It was a really interesting discussion. I think lots of practice-changing information in there, and particularly take-home messages I got were about the sort of clinical assessment, the difference in different areas, about how you might risk assess for VTE. And then the key thing is practice-changing around the DOACs, either bridging prescriptions or taking over those prescriptions in primary care, potentially with shared care with haematology.
Absolutely. I'd agree with all those things, yeah.
And thanks, Nick. And if people want to learn more, then please do see the EKU module, which Nick authored based on the NICE guidelines. Great to chat to you today. Thanks, Nick, very much for your time. And thanks for listening to this podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners, Essential Knowledge Updates.